This is Kenneth Doust, and welcome to installment number 108 of New World Notes. This is the first of two shows on so-called false flag operations. This one is cleverly titled False Flag Operations, an Introduction. It features me, MI5 whistleblower Annie Machan, and the Marx Brothers. I hope you'll stay tuned.
Mrs. Teasdale, this is the last straw. There's no turning back now. This means war!
Fredonia's gone to war. Each native son will grab a gun and run away to war.
Flap, flap, we're going to speak the
lead
along the street to war.
At last the country's gone to war.
It is the country's gone to war.
At last the country's gone to war.
We're going to war.
This is a fact we can't ignore.
We're going to war.
This is a fact we can't ignore.
We're going to war.
In case you haven't heard before.
From the phony incident James Polk used as an excuse to start the Mexican War, to the hilariously inept, pathetic underwear bomber scam last Christmas, false flag operations have been a very common ploy and very effective tool for riling up the citizens to support wars that are not in the citizens' best interests. They're done all the time by all countries. You should be aware of them. This should be your first suspicion when, all of a sudden, everybody is venting outrage at some foreign country or another. The moral of the story? Don't fall for it. Let's play a little mind game. Come with me back to the year, I think it was 1775. Yes, it was the 14th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. Paul Revere's ride, disturbing the peace, urging Americans to awake, to grab their firearms, and to turn out to impede and shoot government agents engaged in the lawful exercise of their duties. Sounds like a riot to me. Then Paul Revere was called a patriot. Today he'd be called a terrorist and sent off to Bagram for 7 years of questioning. The British are coming. They're moving about His Majesty's crown colony of Massachusetts. The British are coming. They owned the place, lock, stock, and barrel. The things they blur over in American history class. My point is, what if the British actually weren't coming? What if they were home, sleeping soundly in bed with Martha Washington? So Paul Revere is riding through every Middlesex County village and farm so the country folk could get up and take arm, and all the colonials are getting their linens twisted out of shape on account of nothing? Wouldn't that be way cool? Imagine, Paul Revere lost a drunken barroom bet with Sam Adams, galloped around proclaiming an entirely spurious false flag narrative, and the next thing you knew, we were free of the King of England and ruled instead by Wall Street financiers. Cool. I don't know what really happened in Massachusetts on the 14th of April. The point is, even if the British had done nothing except sleep with Martha Washington, Revere would have convinced the people that something did happen, and the results would have been the same. Both rebels and authorities realize this, and so, from time to time, in pursuit of their ends, they engage in what we call false flag operations. These happen all the time. Now, in its strictest sense, a false flag operation is an outrage against Side A, perpetrated by forces of Side A, disguised as forces of Side B, in order to provoke Side A public support for commencing hostilities against Side B. I promise not to draw any parallels to 9/11, but here are three classic instances from the 20th century. In 1939, the German Nazi government broadcast all manner of lies, claiming hostile acts against Germany by the neighboring country of Poland. In August 1939, the Nazis grabbed 20 or so inmates of their Dachau concentration camp, dressed the inmates up in uniforms of the Polish army, and drove them to the German town of Gliwice, near the Polish border. German troops ran around, shooting guns, alarming the locals, pretending to defend a radio station that they were pretending Polish invaders were attacking. Germans in Polish uniform temporarily seized the radio station and broadcast anti-German messages. Then the Germans shot the poor slobs from Dachau in the fake Polish uniforms and announced to the world that they had successfully defended the homeland against an unprovoked invasion by Poland. And they had 20 dead bodies in uniform to prove it. The Germans named this caper Operation Canned Goods, referring to the 20 guys from Dachau. Cute. Hitler then used the fake Polish invasion of Germany as one of his justifications for the real German invasion of Poland soon afterwards. The truth about the Gliwice incident came out after the war when one of the planners of the charade testified at Nuremberg. The Russians did the same thing in September 1999. They had the KGB, technically the KGB's successor organization, blow up apartment buildings full of innocent citizens in three Russian cities, Moscow, Voinotsk, and Volgodonsk. They did this with time bombs. The authorities blamed the incidents on Chechen terrorists and used the incidents as a trigger for launching the Second Chechen War that same month, September 1999. Now, Chechnya was part of the Russian Confederation and had both strong secessionist tendencies and terrorists. However, both the Chechen terrorists and the Chechen government have consistently denied for 11 years that they ever bombed those apartment buildings. One odd footnote, all three bombed apartment buildings were low-income housing, not the comfortable living quarters of the rich or even upper working class. The 300 murdered victims, not to mention the thousands made homeless, didn't include anybody important, you'll be not entirely surprised to hear. I promised not to act like a tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist and bring in 9/11, so I won't. If you don't recall 9/11, that was an incident in which a couple dozen alleged terrorists from Saudi Arabia, financed by Saudi Arabian money, allegedly hijacked four commercial airliners. With two of these airplanes, they pulverized three Manhattan skyscrapers. Count them, three. With a third plane, they damaged the Pentagon, which apparently had carelessly turned off its missile defense system earlier that morning. Despite the total lack of air defense of the, quote, homeland, unquote, and the total lack of missile defense of the Pentagon, not one officer or enlisted soldier seems to have been court-martialed, demoted, or even had his weekend pass revoked. The events of 9/11 were then used to justify the invasion, destruction, and occupation of, no, not Saudi Arabia, Iraq, which had nothing to do with damaging the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. And the events were used to justify the doomed attempts to conquer Afghanistan and now Pakistan, too, which countries likewise had nothing to do with damaging the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Apparently, this whole story has been judged completely plausible by the large majority of American citizens. The same people who can utter the phrase TV reality show without the slightest hint of irony. The same people who care deeply about pressing national issues, such as whether that judge on American Idol actually was gay or if he just acted like it. As I said, I promised I will not call 9/11 a false flag operation, and I shall keep my promise, inshallah, which is Arabic for if God permits. So if I break the promise, don't blame me. One final bit of pedantry before I bow out. There are similar scams that technically aren't black flag operations, but work the same. For instance, some minor offense might actually have happened. A month earlier, it might have been overlooked. But now the time is ripe, and the powers that be on side A blow the event way out of proportion, always aided by the media, and turn the minor event into a casus belli. That's how President Polk launched the Mexican War, which ended with the U.S. stealing about half of Mexico. That's how the Pentagon, their tool Harry Truman, and NATO launched the Korean War. Minor cross-border incursions and skirmishes have been going on in Korea by both sides for many months. The heads of the national security state pretended that one minor incursion was a major invasion by the godless communist slave masters of freedom-loving, democratic, Christian South Korea. And, well, are we just going to stand by while all of Asia goes commie? Technically, not a false flag operation, because some little event actually did take place. But it functions the same. Then there were occasions when nothing actually happened, and a wholly fictitious outrage was invented out of thin air, denounced by Side A's leaders, denounced by Side A's free and independent news media. Next thing you know, every SUV in Side A has a Support Our Troops bumper sticker, and hi-ho, it's off to war we go! This happened in August 1964, when the U.S. Navy ship Maddox supposedly was attacked and heavily damaged by North Vietnamese Navy ships in the Gulf of Tonkin on August 4. In response to this totally fabricated hysteria, Congress overwhelmingly passed the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, giving the president, Lyndon B. Johnson, nearly complete power to wage war against the Vietnamese as he saw fit. There were skeptics at the time, and they were drowned out and or silenced. A massive escalation of U.S. military hostilities in Vietnam followed, at a cost of millions of Vietnamese lives, thousands of American lives, and near destruction of the U.S. Army, as the drafted soldiers realized they had been had and rebelled left and right, God bless them. Decades later, it is now understood that there was no attack on the Maddox. The whole story was a lie, made up to justify a massive escalation of what had been a smaller-scale war in Vietnam. Much like a false flag operation, but easier and cheaper. They didn't even have to rent Polish uniforms and return them damaged. There was no operation at all. At least there was no skirmish in the Gulf of Tonkin on August 4. There may have been a little one 2 days earlier, but that's not what got Congress all riled up. There's a more general term that includes bona fide false flag operations, like the attack on Gleiwitz, and it includes little skirmishes that got promoted into major crises, like the one President Polk used to steal half of Mexico. And it includes no-muss, no-fuss, pure fantasies, like the alleged Gulf of Tonkin incident. That general term is phony trigger event. Or we can use the more vivid term false flag operation, defining it loosely. The Christmas underwear bomber scam was a false flag operation of staggering ineptness. Every American with a grammar school education should feel insulted and outraged that the powers that be thought they could pass off such a preposterous charade as a real attempted act of terrorism. Americans may be stupid, but we're not that stupid. The alleged terrorist's father rats on his son to the U.S. State Department, and onto a watch list the kid goes. 5 weeks later, the kid buys a one-way plane ticket from Lagos to Detroit via Amsterdam for $3,000 in cash. He boards the plane in Lagos with no passport, no baggage, and no coat. He must have heard that Detroit is having an exceptionally warm winter. Okay, nothing suspicious so far, right? In Amsterdam, he boards a flight to Detroit. No coat, no baggage, and still no passport. Still nothing suspicious so far, right? Mid-flight, he sets off some high-powered explosives concealed in his underpants. The bomb does not bring down the plane. Does not damage the plane. Apparently does not even do serious damage to the alleged terrorist, who, like the 2001 shoe bomber, is then restrained by annoyed fellow passengers. Following this eighth-grade musical comedy performance, we are told we must extend the oppressive Patriot Act, put expensive full-body X-ray vision scanners in every airport, and start cracking down harder on Muslim terrorists. Right. As I said, false flag operations are not rare. I think we have a right to demand certain minimum standards of quality in our entertainment, and I'm afraid that the show Up, Up and Away with the Underwear Bomber doesn't come close to making the cut. Be on the lookout for more phony triggering incidents. Soon. Incidents that they will blame on Iran, or Syria, or Venezuela. You heard it here first. And let's hear it again from the greatest anti-war movie ever made, Duck Soup. Here in the Grand Legislative Chamber of Fredonia, official business is interrupted by the appearance of rich socialite widow Mrs. Teasdale. Mrs. Teasdale is taking extraordinary measures to prevent the impending war between Fredonia and Sylvania. But like W. Bush in 2003, Fredonian President Rufus T. Firefly is not going to let some peacenik focus group interfere with his plans for a nice little war.
Your Excellency, General Cooper says that the Sylvanian troops are about to land on Fredonia soil. This means war.
Something must be done. War would mean a prohibitive increase in our taxes.
Hey, I got an uncle lives in Texas.
No, I'm talking about taxes, money, dollars.
Dallas. That's where my uncle lives. Dallas, Texas.
More bad news. Didn't I tell you?
Your Excellency.
What's on your mind, babe?
In behalf of the women of Fredonia, I have taken it upon myself to make one final effort to prevent war.
No kidding.
I talked to Ambassador Trentino, and he says Sylvania doesn't want war either.
Either.
Doesn't want war either.
Either. Skip it.
I've taken the liberty of asking the ambassador to come over here because we both felt that a friendly conference would settle everything peacefully. He'll be here any moment.
Mrs. Teasdale, you did a noble deed. I'd be unworthy of the high trust that's been placed in me if I didn't do everything within my power to keep our beloved Fredonia at peace with the world. I'd be only too happy to meet Ambassador Trentino and offer him, on behalf of my country, the right hand of good fellowship. And I feel sure that he will accept this gesture in the spirit in which it is offered. But suppose he doesn't. A fine thing that'll be. I hold out my hand and he refuses to accept it. That'll add a lot to my prestige, won't it? Me, the head of a country, snubbed by a foreign ambassador. Who does he think he is, that he can come here and make a sap out of me in front of all my people? Think of it. I hold out my hand, and that hyena refuses to accept it. Why, the cheap, ball-flushing swine, he'll never get away with it, I tell you. He'll never get away with it. So, you refuse to shake hands with me, eh?
Oh! Mrs. Teasdale, this is the last straw. There's no turning back now. This means war.
And it's war! And it's war! Get on the horses! On the horses! And it's war!
Fredonia's gone to war. Each native son will grab a gun and run away to war.
At last the country's going to war.
This is the country going to war.
At last the country's going to war.
We're going to war.
This is a fact we can't ignore.
We're going to war.
This is a fact we can't ignore. We're going to war.
In case you haven't heard before, I think they think we're going to war. I think they think we're going to war.
We're going to war.
I think they think we're going to war.
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 Marx Brothers in Duck Soup, satirizing the flimsy bases on which our rulers force us to suffer war, all the while piously pretending that they're doing all in their power to prevent it. The film was released in 1933, the same year the Nazis burned the Reichstag and pinned the blame on the commies. Annie Machan and her then-lover David Shaler were prominent English whistleblowers. They worked for MI5 and were in close contact with MI6. These are the British approximate equivalents of FBI and CIA, respectively. We'll hear parts of a talk about false flag operations that Machan gave in London in 2007. From the secret MI5 records that she had read, she'll tell about how the Israeli embassy in London was bombed by, well, actually, the Israelis. And she'll tell why. And remember those low-rent apartment bombings in Russia? She'll come to those, too, and, relatedly, the gruesome assassination of Russian whistleblower Alexander Litvinenko in 2006.
It's just wonderful so many people are interested enough in this subject to turn out after work in an evening to listen to a former spy rabbiting on as usual. I used to work for MI5. I always feel a bit like someone standing up and saying something shameful like at AA. So we move on to the Irish section for 2 years and then into the international terrorism section for 2 years. Now, I won't dwell too long on the Irish section for the purposes of tonight, but there we saw a number of IRA attacks go ahead, which could and should have been prevented by MI5 and by the Metropolitan Police Special Branch. They had prior knowledge. Either they screwed up or they allowed things to go ahead. And this is, again, a problem because that was their primary role in the mid-1990s to protect us from the IRA bombs on the UK mainland. But what I want to focus on spy-wise tonight, the two key cases came up in our last 2 years in MI5. That's when we were working for a section called G Branch, which is looking at international terrorism. The first one, well, both of them actually, are blatant examples of what has become known as false flag terrorism, where an atrocity goes ahead and then it's blamed on a group, but in fact somebody else carried it out for political advantage. The first one was the Israeli embassy bombing in London in 1994. I don't know how many of you remember all the headlines about that. In essence, a car bomb was driven up, parked outside the Israeli embassy, and it exploded. There were no fatalities that day, just a few injuries, a few minor injuries, particularly among the embassy staff. The three senior Israeli diplomats were out of the office that day, very convenient, even though requirements stated that one of the three should always be in the building during working hours. And after the attack, there was, of course, a massive investigation, and two Palestinians who were studying in London were arrested, held on remand, and convicted of the attack. Not of actually carrying out the attack, but of conspiring to carry out the attack. And they were both sentenced to 20 years each. Now, David started working in G Branch shortly after these attacks. But because of the system in MI5, where the work of officers is passed around every week amongst the peer group, amongst the same people in that section, so that people can keep abreast of what's going on, he saw a report written by a senior MI5 officer. And for tonight's purposes, I'll call him G91, but I know who he is. And he had been in charge of the MI5 side of investigations. And his assessment, having seen not only all the evidence, but all the intelligence, which is not necessarily permissible in court, was to come to the conclusion that Mossad had carried out the attack. Now, this sounds like the wilder fringes of conspiracy theory, but as I said, this is a senior MI5 officer. He had access to all the information, and he was convinced Mossad had bombed their own embassy. Now, why? Well, first of all, there had been another large attack against a Jewish interest section in Buenos Aires a few months ago. So the Israelis were continually pestering MI5 for increased protection around their embassy in London. Okay, well, they might let off a controlled explosion or something, try and ramp up the threat. Of course, that happened. But I think the primary objective was that the two Palestinians who were convicted of the attack were actually very politically active in London. They were very involved in building up a support network to send aid and help to the people on the Gaza Strip and the Left Bank. By arresting them and some others around who were not convicted, they shattered this burgeoning support network. Everyone just ran for the hills, they scattered. And to this day, that network hasn't really got back on its feet. So, of course, there's a political advantage for the Israelis to have carried out this attack themselves. And it just beggars belief that David blew the whistle on this in November 1997. Gareth Pierce, who was a very famous lawyer involved in freeing the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, was the lawyer for the Israeli Embassy Two. She also subsequently became the lawyer for David. And she came over to see him in a sort of brush contact in Brussels station at one point to get the evidence off him. They went to appeal. It has been accepted there were documents that were not disclosed during the trial of these two people. And it was a young woman called Sama Alami and a young man at the time called Jawed Botme. Those people, despite an appeal, despite all the case law and evidence being on their side, are still in prison. The judges would not follow basic law to release them, at the very least pending a retrial. So they have been imprisoned since 1995 for a crime they did not commit. If the jury had seen the documents that David was talking about, they would not have convicted these two people. And it looks like they're going to be serving the full 20 years. So this is playing fast and loose with people's lives. They will never be the same again. It's so blatant how the media is controlled and spun in this country. The spies have ways of ensuring that they get a good press. They get the editors, they get the proprietors, have chummy little lunches in the HQ of MI5 and MI6. They sometimes place agents of influence within the newspapers to ensure the right message is always put out. So if you look at the headlines, you look at all these strange headlines around these so-called terror plots in the UK now, screaming headlines, 45 minutes from Armageddon. Remember that one? That's how they do it. I saw it up close and personal. It goes on day in, day out. And that's really why I wanted to just run through some of the MI5 side of things, because we have experienced it. We have seen it from the inside, the false flag terrorism, and we have seen how they react when someone challenges that. We have seen how they can control the media, how they can even control the judiciary to a certain extent. It goes on. It is not some theory. It is fact. And there are many other examples which are now established through judicial inquiry of false flag terrorism. And just to run through a few of them quickly. Everyone remembers the tragic case of Alexander Litvinenko. I mean, what more horror could we face than someone being poisoned by polonium-210 in that death mask agony on the hospital bed? It made such a strong impression on us all. We could all feel for him and empathise. But it was interesting, again, watching the media, how he was always described as a Soviet or Russian dissident. It's like harking back to the good old days of proper spying. We have to bear in mind that what this man did was blow the whistle. And what he blew the whistle on was the bombing of some apartment blocks in Moscow in 1999. Now, this was blamed on Chechen rebels. And this was used as the pretext to formally invade and take power and eradicate the Chechen rebels in Chechnya. But it turns out, the whistleblowing of Alexander Litvinenko, that it was the KGB, or the new form of it, the FSB, who had bombed the apartment blocks themselves to provide the pretext for that war. That was barely mentioned in the media during his death agonies.
And on that cheerful note, I will bid you adieu. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed here are my own. For more information, including my email address, if you'd like to get in touch, check out the show's website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks to the London Sound Posse for the Annie Michon recording. We'll hear more from her next time. It'll get to my non-carborundum. Please tune in again. Please support your friendly neighborhood non-commercial radio station if you can. And ciao.